Precepts, the 10 grave precepts as they're known, and we did the first 5, so I want to carry on. But first of all, I want to just kind of reiterate what I said last time, and that is that these precepts are points of awareness to help one notice how the different ways in which we might make mistakes with regard to how we follow the pure precepts. So it's not the case that they're separate from the pure precepts. The pure precepts cover everything, and the grave precepts basically say, pay particular attention to these things, because this is where people often make mistakes. The pure precepts being, endeavour to not act in such a way as to cause harm and increase suffering. Endeavour to act in a way that promotes good and reduces suffering in the world. And do this with a spirit of offering it for all beings, not just one's own personal ego. And as I said last time, the awareness to allow us to do this arises from the practice. So it's not a question of desperately trying to think how to do it, but rather to allow the practice to make you more aware of the ways in which mistakes happen. Aware of one's own personal tendencies, aware of the ways in which our particular personalities, can get us into trouble, and use that awareness to notice, and that act of noticing can transform gently these the tendencies for the mind to make mistakes, can transform the mind naturally, unconsciously, and automatically over time. And as I said last time, sometimes it's necessary to be more firm with oneself if one notices that one regularly makes mistakes and there's a kind of very strong tendency that needs to be broken. Then sometimes that's necessary. But ideally, from a Zen point of view, we simply use an awareness, a gentle awareness of our actions and the way those actions go wrong to transform those actions in a more natural way, as opposed to trying to make things desperately happen. And then I spoke about the first 5 precepts. Not to kill, to avoid violence. Not to steal. And not to take what is not yours. And I spoke about how it's not only about material things, but also about credit. The different ways in which our ego maybe wants to take from others. Credit, taking more food than we need when there's maybe less to go around. Making sure that our sexuality is expressed in the world in a way that's appropriate, a way that doesn't cause harm for others, doesn't cause harm for ourselves, and promotes life rather than denying life. I spoke about not lying and expressing the truth appropriately. Doing it in a way which expressing the truth in a way which again protects life and doesn't cause harm for others. Not using the truth as a weapon, but also not using lies as a weapon. And noticing how our ego gets caught up in the way that we talk about things. How sometimes lies or harsh truths can be used to kind of or even exaggerations, not even necessarily lies, but if we talk about exaggerations, how these can come from a place of wanting to make our ego look a bit better. And the last one I spoke about was don't be trapped by intoxicants. And I spoke about how Master Deshi and I interpreted that as more than just alcohol. The original precept actually was specifically about alcohol, because that was a challenge in India, because, as I said last time, alcohol was less of a part of the culture, and it tended to be very strong, unlike in Europe, where weaker alcohol brews like beer were used to preserve water. That's not what happened in India. But Deshi Maru interpreted it as more broad than that, and said we must also not be intoxicated by ideas, and how even the idea of being kind of how Zen should be, how Buddhism should be, all of these can be a problem. And so we shouldn't use being intoxicated, whether it's by alcohol or by ideas, as a way of clouding our minds, using these things as a crutch to stop us from thinking or from escaping reality. Rather, whether we engage with alcohol, if it's not a problem for you, it's okay from a Zen point of view to do so. But it shouldn't be a crutch. It shouldn't be something that. And similarly with ideas, it should be, all these things should be done in a way that promotes awareness and promotes understanding, rather than something that fixes and traps the mind. So don't trap the mind with poisons. So those are the first five that I spoke about. So I wanted to speak about the other five, since there's 10 altogether, of the grave precepts. And the first, number six, is not to criticise. Don't speak ill against others. And I remember one of our founders, Nancy, saying this is the one that she found hardest. I remember her saying that was the one that she found hardest to avoid criticising. Criticising could come from a place of ego. You know, criticising tends to come from a place of ego, and it might be a way of making yourself look better than the other and putting someone else down. But in Nancy's case, it wasn't. It was still from a place of ego, but it was her kind of perfectionist tendencies, in that she wanted the dojo, the ways that things were done in the dojo, to be perfect, exact. She was, and so she noticed this in herself, and would kind of take care to try to hold back a little bit of her tendency to kind of come straight out with criticizing. Criticizing speaking ill of others can be a way of ego. It might be to put someone down, or it might be speaking ill of them behind their back, which is more something about currying favor with someone else. But also we need to be aware that sometimes not criticizing might be an act of ego, or rather not coming forward with something that needs to be said. It might be fear that stops us coming forward. There might be things that need to be said, and we're not finding a way to bring that forward. And so that can also be an act of ego. So our relationship with how we express our opinions in the world of others and what they're doing, how can it be done in a way that's more constructive, rather than something that is egoically tangled up? So how can we do it in a way that is effectively letting go of the ego, whether that is an ego that wants to dominate the other person, or whether that's an ego that's afraid of the response from the other person? And both of those can get in the way and mean that the way in which we express our views are done in a way which is not appropriate to the situation. And so again, it's an act of awareness. It's noticing how we make these mistakes, noticing tendencies in our ego to get involved with these things, and doing our best to let go of the ego at the time when something needs to be said, and seeing what happens. So, yeah, that's not to speak ill against others, not to criticise. And then the next is, don't get... Oh, and I would say about that, I would say that... So, sometimes something needs to be said, But it might not be your job to say it, even if you notice someone else, so someone else making a mistake or whatever. It might not be your job to say it. It might be because you might not be the right person to say it, even if it needs to be said. That's the other thing to say about this, is that there's sometimes a tendency to feel that we have to intervene, and if sometimes you can just let it be, and there might be someone else's job it is, who is maybe has a different relationship with that person, because there's a risk that I'll give you an example here, that there was someone who was it used to be in this dojo who liked to kind of correct people's posture, and it might well be that the posture correction was appropriate, but nonetheless it would be sometimes people would really resist it, and sometimes that was a kind of, it was because even if that posture correction was appropriate, they didn't respond well to that particular person making the correction, if you see what I mean, because they correctly or incorrectly interpreted it as a kind of act of authority from someone that they didn't necessarily feel should provide that authority to them in that moment. So those are the kind of so it might be that something that even if what you're doing is the right thing in terms of correcting someone, you might not be the right person to do it, and in which case just accept that and sit back, and maybe someone else will step forward, someone who is the right person. Maybe it will just pass, and maybe this time it's right for it just to pass. So that's the sixth precept, not to criticise. The next is not to get tangled up in pride, not to get tangled up in feeling good about ourselves. I want to be clear that it's okay to feel good about yourself. It's good to feel good about yourself, but it's just that we don't want to get tangled up in it, and it become something that, in fact, in French, they have two different words for pride. One of which is kind of okay pride, and one of which is exaggerated pride, fier and orgueil. And getting overly wrapped up in pride, where it exaggerates the ego. So it's okay to feel, okay, I've done something good, I can pat myself on the back about it, I feel good about it. Now, let it go and move on to the next thing. That's good, I would say. Especially since, I would say, in the West, we have a tendency to, many of us have a tendency to be overly critical of ourselves. And even the people that appear not to be overly critical of themselves and appear to be a bit prideful, often that prideful expression in the world is coming from a place of insecurity. And as many of you know, my wife Ilse, she lived in Dharam Masala. Before she joined the Zen community, she was teaching English to nuns in a Tibetan nunnery in India, refugee nuns. And so she would kind of interact with the Tibetan community more generally, and had some interactions with the Dalai Lama. She went on to be part of a charity which had the Dalai Lama as the patron, and so she had interactions with him. And she told me the story about how someone said that someone was kind of speaking with the Dalai Lama, a Westerner, and was talking about this kind of lack of self-worth, which and the Dalai Lama literally did not understand that this was something that was kind of quite alien to that culture. And Ilse expressed it is that in the Tibetan culture, they don't feel guilt, but they do feel shame. Shame is more of a community feeling, rather, this kind of lack of sense of self-worth is something that is less common in a more communitarian society as they have in Asia, like the Tibetan society. It's the kind of downside of our individualism, which in other ways frees us from many constraints of expectations of society. So pride can come, so this kind of over pride can come also from this lack of self-worth. So it's good to pat ourselves on the back, but just let go of it after that. Okay, you know, that's how I am. But also I would say, as part of this precept, also notice how we get tangled up in blame, self-blame, because blame and pride, you know, feeling too good about ourselves and feeling too bad about ourselves are the same coin. They're both acts of ego. And so feeling good about yourself, feeling you've done something well, but not feeling you're particularly special. In the end, Zen is about realising that we're not special. We're neither dramatically better than anyone else, nor dramatically worse than anyone else. And if someone kind of pretends to be dramatically better as an act of ego, in some ways, kind of overemphasizing how bad you are and being the kind of community Eeyore is also an act of ego. And so just noticing how we get kind of caught up in these things, noticing how we get caught up in our sense of self-worth and letting go of it. And also I would say working on it, because as I said, for many of us, it is there is a certain kind of lack of self-worth which we need to work on, but doing it in ways which doesn't cause harm to others. So don't get tangled up in pride. Don't feel that you're something special, which includes not feeling that you're specially bad. So next, cultivate generosity and openness to others. Give freely. Give without selfishness. And so giving is an important part of our practice. And this is giving in many ways. It can be material giving. It can be giving in terms of time. It can be cooking for others. It can be cooking for the Sangha. It can be doing the Samu, cleaning the place. It can be tidying up, like Anna kindly did the other day. So giving to others, to the community, to those in need beyond the community, in whatever way is appropriate, using our life to give. And that can also be through our work, giving through our work in ways that we offer to the world in ways. And having a spirit of doing this without selfishness. Being open to people's needs and giving without selfishness. And noticing also how our ego gets caught up in this. So it might be that we don't feel like, we don't particularly like giving. It might be, Nancy, I think she translated this precept as don't be stingy, is what she likes. She had some quite earthy ways of translating a number of these precepts, so don't be stingy. So noticing where you hold back in life. Where is it that you hold back from giving? Where is it that you resist giving? But also notice how we might use giving, again, to express the ego. Giving as a way of looking good in the eyes of others. Giving as a way of controlling others. Give in a way to make someone feel they're indebted to us. So that's different from whether or not they're indebted to us. So it might be that we give without a sense of wanting to be indebted to us, but their ego makes them feel indebted to us because they can't just accept the gift. So that's also possible. You know, the way that we accept gifts can also be an act of ego, not wanting to accept something. I would say also around that, I would say there's also about just simply giving words of praise and appreciation. So it doesn't have to be, you know, kind of huge amounts of money or anything. Just appreciating, just giving credit or saying thanks. And so recently I actually, there's a friend of mine who I kind of just really appreciated because he's kind of been helpful. And I just sort of, it was interesting because I kind of just simply expressed sincerely in a couple of sentences my appreciation for him. He's not a Zen practitioner, just to be clear. And he was quite embarrassed. He found it difficult to receive. I think he's an English male, basically. He found it quite difficult to receive. I think he really appreciated that, he found it very difficult to receive just simply a genuine act of thanks and then a genuine act of appreciation. And so noticing how our egos, can get caught up in both giving and receiving. And again, letting go, because in some of the chants it says, a true act of giving, there is no giver, there is no receiver, and there is no gift. In other words, the act of giving just disappears into the cosmos. We abandon the ego, both the giver and the receiver abandons the ego through that. So learning to both give and to receive. You'll notice that often when I'm looking at one of these precepts, I'm saying, don't just look at the thing it says explicitly, but look at the dual of it. So giving and receiving, criticizing or avoiding, fearing to engage with others. You know, that's a, so all of these things are, you can see the kind of dual of these. And when I spoke about sexuality the other week, I was saying that a sexuality which enforces very strong morality on other people or oneself can also be damaging. So it's not always about what one does, it can also be about what one doesn't do or claims what one doesn't do. So that's cultivate, so that's precept 8. Don't be stingy, cultivate generosity and openness to others. Be open hearted in both giving and receiving. Number 9, anger. See how, and anger, as many of you will know, is one of the 3 poisons in Buddhism. Anger is something. And see how anger arises within us and is expressed in the world. And be careful. Observe how the anger arises, how flashes of anger, we all have it. And often, as I said before, it's connected with fear. So anger, fear, very intimately related, same kind of mental, biological system, the fight-flight response. So see how it comes up, see how it can dominate and shape our actions in the world, see how it makes our ego, how our sense of self constrict and get caught up, see how it makes mistakes, whether that mistake again is being too angry out front or equally repressing it, holding it right in and not letting it out into the world. If we can observe the anger and then let it flow into the world in a way which is generative and helpful to the situation. And sometimes the helpful, so particularly for people who have strong anger, sometimes the helpful thing is to hold it right back and to learn to hold it right back. For someone who maybe bottles it up, the helpful thing might be to express it. There was trying to remember which Indian teacher. There was an Indian teacher, he was one of the great 19th century teachers, and I can't remember which one he was. But there was a story about how 2 of his disciples were on a boat going back to see him, and they overheard someone who was criticising him. And one of the disciples kind of went in and really had a go at this guy. And the other disciple kind of held back and avoided it. And when they reached the teacher, the story had reached the teacher about what happened. And the teacher basically said to the first disciple who'd had a go at this guy, why did you have a go at that guy? Why did you let your anger get the better of you? And to the other student, he said, why did you not speak up and defend me? You see? Again, it's to do with, because in both cases, they were caught up in their ego. And so, they were trapped by their own egoic response to their anger. In one case, that was an anger that was expressed in the world inappropriately, and the other way, in another case, it was an anger that was held back inappropriately. So, can we find ways of transforming this feeling in ourselves into a more creative way? And in fact, I was thinking about, you know, going back to don't speak ill against others, because often that's linked. And I remember Jean Babi saying, before you criticise someone, and you can say this about expressing anger in the world, it was an expression his mother used. Jean is the other founder, Nancy and Jean were 2 founders of the dojo. His mother used to say, before you criticise someone, turn your tongue round in your mouth 10 times. And so really, that's so you could say, take a deep breath. You know, that's another way of saying it, but effectively, before you don't just come out, you need to kind of take some time, and you can say the same about expressing the anger into the world. So in other words, anger not as something that dominates and is a master of the ego, but something that can flow in the world. And I'll say about that, because I mentioned before about the kind of don't be intoxicated by ideas. One of the most dangerous forms of anger in the world these days is righteous anger, where we are absolutely certain about how things should be. Jean Babi used to call this the demon of good, and how much harm is done in the name of the demon of good, and how righteous anger and certainty when expressed in a way that is just too certain, can lead to more division and more hatred rather than to peace. And so when one needs to stand up for something, and there are things that need to be stood up for in this world, can it be done in a way which is not from a place of egoic righteous anger, but can be done in a way which builds bridges rather than burning bridges, even with people who maybe you disagree with? And so finally, the last one. All of those, all the first nine, are things that, if you like, are universal. You can imagine anyone who's not a Buddhist kind of applying them. The last one is the Buddhist one. And what it says is, protect and honour the three treasures of Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. From a Zen point of view, it means not... you should neither take them too seriously, nor take them not seriously enough. So you can kill the Buddha by creating an image of exactly how things should be, and being kind of dogmatic. So dogmatism is also a way of killing the Buddha. And on the other hand, it's also just not taking it too seriously, being a bit too flippant. So finding a pathway between righteousness and flippancy, if you see what I mean, in our Buddhist path, which means, you know, joking a little bit about things, not taking ourselves too seriously. John Babi used to say, you should take the practice seriously, but don't take yourself seriously. And that means, you know, so it means. It means having a joke every now and then, joking about what we do, yeah. But nonetheless, in our hearts, being sincere about Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And as I said before, being sincere about the Buddha is being sincere about the engagement with the wider self within us, the Buddha nature within us, and respecting that Buddha nature. So in other words, which is effectively letting go of the ego. Being sincere about the Dharma means taking the practices of Zen seriously, particularly other aspects of practice as well, but from a Zen point of view, the practice of Zazen is what's most important. And being sincere about the Sangha is making sure that we treat each other with respect, particularly when things are difficult, particularly when we don't get on with someone. Yeah, and there's always people that rub each other up the wrong way. That's the nature of life. And in Zen, we need to find a way of respecting the person who practices, even if they piss us off sometimes. And so Master Deshimaru, he was probably quoting someone before, probably Dogen, I suspect, but he was saying that basically we need to harmonise like milk and honey. And so build a harmonious community, harmonise like milk and honey. Make sure that in the community you promote harmony by forgiving others for their personalities, which may be different from how you would choose them to be. Forgiving others, it doesn't mean necessarily that you don't, as I said before, it doesn't mean you hide criticism, but it might not be your job to criticise a given person, it might be someone else's job. Basically forgiving others and seeing the best in each other, beyond the personality. So those are the 10 precepts, and as I said before, they are, and you'll have seen the way that I presented them and interpreted them, is they are not rules that you, if you do this you're following them, if you don't do this you're breaking them. That's not what they are. They are points of awareness to make one aware of the way in which we live our lives, and points of awareness to help us think about how we follow the pure precepts, how we reduce suffering in the world, how we avoid causing suffering, and how we promote harmony. So as a result of that, from a Zen point of view, the heart of the precepts is the practice, because the practice is what allows us to go beyond the egoic games and become aware. Which is why, as I said last time, that's different from certain other traditions. So I mentioned Ilse, who she was in the nunnery in the Dalai Lama's tradition, in the Gelugpa tradition, which is a tradition where you study and follow the precepts for a long time before you do a lot of meditation. But from a Zen point of view, meditation is first, and from meditation, from the practice of the Zen, then the awareness to follow the precepts develops, rather than the following the precepts being what allows us to meditate. But there is a kind of a virtuous circle. If you practice, you become more aware. Your life becomes more less complicated. The sangha becomes more harmonious, which in turn creates a space which makes practice easier. And so there is a virtuous circle. Practice promotes awareness, promotes harmony, promotes practice. And from a wider point of view, the point of following the precepts is not to be a good person, to get cosmic credit card points, but rather it is to promote harmony in the world. As I said before, and I think it was Stephen Batchelor who said this, it's not to be a good person as in good rather than evil, but it's to be a good person in the sense that a good knife cuts well, a good person persons well. Yeah, so it's about that rather than trying to be a good rather than evil person. It's someone who creates a life, builds a life which promotes harmony around themselves, not by desperately trying to make that happen, but simply by living from a genuine and sincere and aware place. So I'll stop there. Thank you for your listening. Has anyone got any questions?